get older, losing my head. Many years from now, will you still be sending me a valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
This is Dr. Rob Stahl bringing you the only local call-in radio program exclusively for older adults and caregivers. What should you expect at your age? The answer is a lot, and that's what we're here to explain. It's Monday, February 7th, 2005, and welcome to today's show. Last month, we discussed sports and aging with former Buffalo Bill, Mr. Charlie Ferguson, and Buffalo Rehab physical therapist, Ray Hamill. If you missed the show, you can hear it again from the show's website, whatshouldyouexpect.com, all one word, except for the dot. I'm happy to have with me today local physician, pulmonologist, Dr. Alex Gelfer, an expert in lung disease and sleep problems. And we also have Professor Linda Zemel, UB English professor, and dream interpretation expert. Interesting combination for today's show. The phone number for your calls is 855-6848, and we're all here to answer your questions. Let's get started with Dr. Gelfer. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be interested in sleep problems?
First of all, thank you very much for inviting me for the show. It was very exciting. It was very interesting to come here to the studio and be across the table from this host who introduced their to their audience physicians and also a professor who will be on the show today. I started my residency in Englewood Hospital in 1983, and at that time they had a small sleep laboratory there. I was involved in a sleep study, which was very rudimentary study. At that time they did study during the day, even they called them sleep study. When I finished my residence in Englewood, I moved to University of Rochester, where I did my fellowship. We also did a daytime sleep study, which was further expansion of my horizon in regards of sleep. They have also a sleep laboratory in Rochester, where I started working and become more interested in the sleep. And then I did my fellowship in pulmonary critical care and did my sleep training at University of Alabama in Birmingham until I came to Buffalo and we opened sleep laboratory at St. Joseph's Hospital.
Well, a Southern accent and Russian accent. How did that work together, if I might ask?
Well, it worked very well. One of my mentors was Puerto Rican, and I have the Russian Puerto Rican Southern accent.
Wow, very interesting. Well, Dr. Gelfer started a wonderful sleep lab at St. Joseph's Hospital, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about that later. Now, Dr. Zemel, Professor Zemel. Ms. Professor. She has all kinds of things that could go along with her name. Maybe we'll just say Linda.
You could do that.
tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in dream interpretation.
Do you know, I became interested in it totally by accident. What happened was that in 1980, I started keeping a journal of my dreams just because I tend to be a vivid dreamer, and it seemed an interesting thing to do. And what happened was that I would put the date on them and throw them in my sock drawer, you know, or in a shopping bag, and literally until 1995, 15 years later, I hardly ever looked at them. I kept them, and I began to wonder several years later why I was doing that, you know. So in 1995, I sat down and decided to try to find a way to index them. And in taking all of these loose pieces of paper, all dated but not in a book, I was able to arrange them, take them apart, arrange them again, until I came up with kind of a eureka moment, and I saw in it a method of interpreting dreams that I had not seen before.
And we'll talk a little bit about that as we go along.
And now it's 2005, so add another 10 years.
You have a lot of dreams
written
down.
A lot of pieces
of paper, and probably a lot of single socks too, right?
What can I tell you?
Okay. A few statistics to start off. And Dr. Gelfer provided me with these. Before Thomas Edison invented the light bulb, people averaged 10 hours of sleep a night. It was probably a lot darker than two, well, obviously a lot darker without the light bulb, and that may have certainly helped with sleep. Since then, it's only 7 hours a night on average on weeknights and 7.5 hours on weekends. You'd think it would be 9 hours on weekends, but I guess everyone wants to get up and do all the things they can't do during the week, so it's not too much different. Two-thirds of older adults report frequent sleep problems, while only 1 in 8 say a problem has been addressed formally by their physician. Now, one of the most common complaints I get from my patients is that they're having trouble sleeping. Dr. Gelfer, if a patient came in to you, and I'm sure many do, and you get the referrals, so you probably get the toughest problems, where do you go from there?
Well, very important to start with the simple things, to check the patient's sleep time. Time they go to bed and time they get up. Ask the question about how many times they get up during the night, sometimes to go to the bathroom, sometimes have something to drink or to eat. And from there, we get the full history of their sleep problems. We're also involved in not only in the sleep history but also general medical history on these patients, as well as social history, because a lot of social impact on sleep, as you know, as well as medical impact, a lot of medical problems, neurological problems, psychiatric problems really end up with a poor sleep quality or shorter sleep than a patient would have otherwise. In addition, social situation also influence on the sleep quality and sleep length. I think the main problem in sleep prep now is the sleep deprivation. In other words, people don't have enough sleep. And main problem is not a medical problem, main problem is a social. We have very fast paced of life, we have a lot of things to do, and unfortunately we do it in expense of our sleep. Sleep getting shorter and shorter because we want to put a lot of things in a short period of time.
I don't know, you know, if you know this off the top of your head, but how do we compare to other countries that might have a slower paced life, or rural versus urban populations?
Oh, it's a very interesting question, because the question came up about siesta. You know, some eastern countries and also southern countries, including China, Middle Eastern countries, India.
Right, they have the siesta during the day.
And when they did a study on siesta in United States versus siesta in other countries, they noticed that if people sleep longer than 1 hour during the siesta, the lifespan actually shorter than the people who sleep less than an hour. A different explanation, we can go into this. But when they look at the siesta in the countries where the siesta is a cultural thing, they realize the total sleep time, the number of hours that they sleep total, including siesta, is about 8 hours. Therefore, they have shorter sleep during the night, but they add 2 hours of sleep during the day.
So does that shorter lifespan affect them too?
Well, it does not affect the countries and where this culture of siesta exists.
Okay.
But interestingly enough, when they done study on elderly population, and especially population of the nursing home in the United States, they documented that sleeping more than an hour actually shortened their lifespan.
Very interesting. Now, Linda, I must admit, asking about dreams has not been something I've been very religious about or have even asked at all to my patients.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something I should start doing?
Well, I'll tell you what, if I were a physician, I would. And I don't know, you know, what your practice is like or how you relate to your patients, although I'll bet it's on a level where they would feel very comfortable asking you for help with dreams. So what I would do would be to give a sort of an opening remark that indicates that you're receptive to questions about it. I might say to a patient, I'm interested in dreams and I'm wondering if you ever have any that interest you too. So I would, do you see what I mean? I would indicate to them that you have some interest in it and encourage them, if they feel like it, to talk about them. But, you know, people have different kinds of outlets for the thoughts and emotions that they have, and not everybody expresses those things in their dream life as vividly as others, and not everybody has an interest in it. So I certainly wouldn't say that it's necessary. But for those who might want to discuss either a particularly vivid set of dreams or a repeating dream or a theme in a dream that disturbs them, I certainly would indicate that you'd love to hear about it.
And also, I imagine just as people have different superstitions and different ways of culturally interpreting things, religious beliefs, superstitions, that sort
right.
of thing, some people might really have put a lot of stock in what their dreams are telling them.
You would be surprised how many people do put a lot of stock into it and don't want to admit it if they are suspicious that you will in some way demean them for believing in those things. As a matter of fact, culturally, the history of dream interpretation is extremely old. Anybody who thinks that Freud and Jung started the whole thing hasn't looked far enough into their history books, because if you look at the ancient Greeks, who literally would deliberately sleep outside the temples of Apollo in order to have a healing dream, you have a history that transcends medicine. I don't mean to say that the medical approach to dreams isn't good, but it's very finite. And I think the study of dreams is larger than, although it encompasses the study of medicine.
Now, healing dreams, let's switch back to Dr. Gelford. Dreams generally occur in REM sleep, and REM sleep is very important in terms of having your sleep be worthwhile.
Let me make some comment. We remember sleeps that occur during the REM sleep, but some studies document that dreams occurred only during the delta sleep and sometimes even stage 2 sleep. We just don't remember them because the REM sleep is active sleep. You know, there are several stages of sleep. We call them non-REM sleep and REM sleep. There are 5 stages of sleep. Stage 1 is very light. Stage 2 is a little bit deeper sleep. Stage 3, what we call deep sleep, it's a delta sleep. Also stage 4, even more deep sleep. And then we go to the REM sleep, that rapid eye movement sleep that interprets a very active sleep. Fortunately, we paralyze normally in this sleep. That's why we cannot act. Because some people who not paralyzed during the REM sleep, they're acting in their sleep, which leads to
sleepwalkers.
No, it's not sleepwalkers. Sleepwalkers occur actually in the beginning of the sleep. It's called REM behavior disorder.
And what kinds of things might those
people
do?
Person acting, you know, sometimes they're doing very strange things that become very violent. They jumping out of bed. They could hit their bed partner. I had patients who would broke the wall behind the bed. They will hit it with a fist with so much effort and strength that they break the wall behind their bed. And this type of disorder is very disturbing to the patient, to their loved one who observes this patient acting in their sleep, and also it could be very damaging. It could hurt the patient and others, and it should be treated. And we have the ability to treat this patient. We put them on medication called clonazepam.
So dreams occur in REM sleep and also in delta sleep?
Delta sleep, anything that's occurred in stage 2 sleep.
Okay.
But we don't really remember those sleep. The REM sleep, when dream occurred in REM sleep, we remember that because we remember it, but we can't act.
So what does it mean if a patient tells you that they don't remember having any dreams for months or years? Does that tell you something about their sleep pattern?
Oh, we definitely question if they have REM sleep, and those are the type of patients who might have sleep disorder, which disturb their sleep architecture, and as a result, they don't have REM sleep. And REM sleep is a very important part of our sleep. In the REM sleep, it's fine-tuning of our internal system, of our organs, on our brain. That's why we have to have a REM sleep. That's why we have those vivid dreams, because the body is very, brain and body very actively tuning itself. And when REM sleep is absent, the people actually suffer. And there's some study indicated that if a person doesn't have REM sleep for more than 2 months, it could led to a very bad outcome, even death.
Well, what kind of symptoms might people have the following day or weeks if they're going on a prolonged basis without REM sleep?
Oh, they feel very tired. Their daytime performance decreases. Their memory is not as sharp as had been. Their the bottom line, they're not as active, as not as sharp as the people who have the very good sleep and adequate REM sleep.
And I believe they might also be depressed, might have headache in certain types of sleep disorders.
Correct. If the patient have lacking of sleep in general, sometimes they present with the morning headaches. It's very common, or even headache during the day. But this is relates to the whole gamut of sleep disorder, not only the absence of REM sleep.
Well, I had the interesting opportunity to sleep overnight at the St. Joseph Sleep Lab, one in preparation for the show, and also I had been told that I had periods where I stopped breathing at night for periods, short periods, of course, and that I snored very loudly. And this is a study that's available pretty much to anyone, and they hooked me up with all kinds of wires, and maybe I'll put a picture that I took during that onto the website attached to this show so you could see what's involved. Mm-hmm. But actually, it was very comfortable, even with being hooked up to everything. And I'm a relatively young person, 47 years old. I weigh about 205 pounds. I'm 5'10". And the studies seem to indicate that I might have a problem with sleep apnea. Why don't you say a little bit about sleep apnea and how common it is, and what might tip off a person to look into that possibility?
Sleep apnea, the cessation of breathing during the sleep. When the patient or person make an effort to breathe, but his airway actually closed and he cannot take a deep breath in or let the air out of the lungs. Because of this, our two things happen. Number one, oxygen level in the blood goes down because there's no air, no oxygen coming into the lungs. Number two, brain trying to protect us from dying from the oxygen going too low actually wakes up. And we have a patient who has those episodes more than 60 times an hour, sometimes 120 times an hour, every 30 seconds. And as you can imagine, if each time they go into the sleep apnea and their brain wake up, they don't sleep at all. Even those people sleepy, somebody look at them and said, my God, he's sleepy all the time. What's happening, actually, they don't sleep. They tired, because they don't have a normal sleep at all. And it's very disturbing because 2% of male population in the country and 4% of female have these problems. And we're getting older, and older population having these problems even more often, with, say, about 3/4 of adult population, as you said, have problems with sleeping. And I would add to it about 40% of patients after age 40 have sleep apnea.
Hmm. Well, you know, the tracing of the study, the following morning, it's all computerized and you get nice tracings. It actually did show that I was waking up, not so that I noticed that I was waking up, but that my sleep became very light, essentially non-existent. And the funny thing was, I didn't even notice. When the technicians asked me in the morning, how did you feel you slept? And I said, I thought I had a very restful night's sleep. So you might even not notice that you're waking up. And I'm looking forward to see what can be done about it, and maybe I'll feel perkier during the day and accomplish even more things. I don't know how much more I can stuff in, but it should be interesting at least to correct a problem that might be holding me back.
Have you ever had a dream about that problem? Not to be silly here, but you know, sometimes when you dream, your dreams can let you know things that are amiss in your own body. I don't know if you've ever had experience with patients telling you about that, Alex, or Rob.
Not in exact words, but I know the people complaining of lacking of sleep, and more and more study documented that sleep apnea leads to hypertension, depression, diabetes, mood swings, and or strokes. We know that some patients who have the underlying heart disease might suffer terrible consequences related to sleep disorder. we all know that the patient, the deepest sleep occur in the early morning hours, and then we have the longest REM sleep. In the REM sleep, body is paralyzed, as I mentioned above, and the oxygen goes to the lowest level. If a person has underlying cardiac problems, let's say they have occluded their coronary vessels, the heart can't handle it. It's not enough fuel coming to the heart, and they might have cardiac arrhythmia and have a heart attack. You all heard about the recent death of Mr. White, you know, the football player,
right,
who died in sleep and thought to be related to
sleep apnea.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned that sleep problems could even cause memory problems. Now, would you recommend that people who are experiencing memory problems, they might think they're developing Alzheimer's disease or they really don't know what's wrong, should they automatically have a sleep study or at least be asked the questions about how well they're sleeping and get that looked into?
Well, definitely. I 100% agree with you in this. It's very important what you just mentioned on the radio to our listeners. Some memory loss or not feeling well or even that we called chronic fatigue syndrome sometimes could be explored and could be related to a subtype of sleep disorder. That's why evaluation in the sleep laboratory is always an option. I don't think somebody has to self-refer himself or herself to the sleep laboratory. They definitely need to discuss first with their primary physician their symptoms, and physician will do some evaluation to see if the first step would be sleep laboratory or something else needs to be done, because a lot of other medical problems would lead to the same symptoms. But on a big scale, I think the sleep study is a study which is available in Buffalo. It's not difficult to schedule, and we have several laboratories that they can do this study, and everybody, of course, welcome to St. Joseph Hospital Sleep Lab, and we can do a full scale of the sleep evaluation. And I think having this option available, that people, patients, always have to discuss their sleep problems, lack of sleep, or frequent awakenings during the sleep, or not feeling well in the morning or morning headaches with our physician.
Well, it seems also that there are probably a lot of physicians that don't even think about sleep as part of the problem that might be really affecting a patient in a lot of ways. I know just preparing for this show and talking with you, going through the sleep study, is really what raised my awareness, and I intend to really keep an eye open when I see my patients here on out. Do you find that that's the case, that you constantly need to educate and explain and raise awareness for the medical community?
Using the statistic that's available to me, 6 years ago, in medical curriculum in medical school, 6 years ago, not now, I don't have a current data, but 6 years ago, there were only 3 hours spent on the sleep disorders in entire medical school curriculum.
And probably the medical students sleep through that, right?
I hope not.
Now, Linda, do you find the nature of dreams in patients who have sleeping problems is different?
That's an interesting question, and I have to tell you that because I'm not a physician, I haven't really asked intentionally people that come to me for advice or need some help with dream situations. I haven't really said to them, are you having trouble sleeping? What I tend to do is to look at the dream content, and that's different from the physical, what shall we say, the physical entity of the body asleep, if you catch my drift. I'm more interested in what it is that they're dreaming about. And what I have people do really is a two-pronged sort of method. Obviously, there are many, many prongs, but there are two prongs that I would initially start with. I would probably say to people who came to see me that if they just jot down what they dream and put the date on it and do as I did, and in an informal, almost disorganized way, just put it away for a while and save them up for maybe a month. And then what you do is take them all out someday when you know, have some time and you're not rushed, line them all up chronologically and read through them as if you were reading a novel or a play. And frequently you will see your mind working on a problem, finishing it up, resolving it in part, and then starting on a new problem, almost as if it were a subplot in a book. And if you do this on a fairly frequent basis, in other words, relaxing yourself about the whole process, keeping it really anxiety-free, just write them down, put them away, write them down, put them away, and then sometime later, let some time pass, take them out and read them over. You will sometimes see that, in fact, the events that you were dreaming about have already come to be. Not necessarily specifically, although in my case, because I have a 25-year dream journal, I do see specifically where they came to be. Sometimes 6 months, sometimes 12 years later, I kid you not, names, dates, places, what people were wearing, and bits of dialogue exactly. It's become a matter of fascination and study to me beyond the usual. But even with people who don't keep that lengthy a dream journal, they will see themselves working on a problem. The second prong that I would say in my method for just, you know, ordinary people who come wanting to know more about their dreams is to recommend that they look at their dreams as if they are looking at a snapshot, you know, or a home movie, and to notice which items are specifically one color or another. Is there a recurring color? Are there recurring shapes? Are there other clues like the weather? You know, does good weather in the dream tend to mean that something good is happening in the dream? After a while, what happens is that you can pinpoint many of your own symbols, and then you have a clue, no pun intended, if you have a dream that tends to be about an event that has not yet happened in your life. You tend to have a clue whether or not that will be associated with good times or not so good times. It's really a more finite and almost literary method than you would think. It's not at all woo-woo or strange or witch-like or any of the kinds of things that people like to peg it with.
And you're an English professor.
And I'm definitely not a witch.
No, I can't.
So, although, you know, there have been, you know,
no
the words that rhymes with it. Yeah, but it's actually very much like reading poetry.
Now, you've written a book called Dreaming Your Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A.
Right.
And you also have an e-book, an online book called The Dharma is in the Details.
You bet.
So we'll put those links on the website, and people can call you if they want more information about that.
You know what a dharma is, don't you?
Is this a joke or
no?
What
no,
is it?
Not a joke.
Go ahead, tell us. I didn't know if I was being set up.
Yeah, no, I could have been if I had a joke to
just
go
the
with
way
that.
You
I
phrased
would
it. I was a little worried, so I'll let you explain.
He's worried across the table.
I'll
here.
Let you.
No,
I'll
the Dharma is simply the life path. There are cultures, not
this
necessarily.
This is Buddhist. This
yeah,
is Buddhist
it's not
philosophy.
The Western culture, yeah, right. Although you know it's become mine. I have to admit, the idea of a life path, that in fact there may be certain kinds of trials and tribulations and also good times that we go through in a lifetime, and that clues to these will appear in our dreams. And I do write about that in both those books, although they're extremely accessible to our Eastern culture as well as our Western culture also.
Yeah, and, you know, Dharma is more a concept, a way of living more than
sure.
a specific religion, and it can be consistent with all religions.
Absolutely.
Really incorporated into your life. Well, this is all very interesting. I'll remind you again, the phone number is 855-6848. We welcome your calls. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Oh, we Hush, my darling, don't fear, my darling, the lion sleeps tonight. Hush, my darling, don't fear, my darling, the lion sleeps tonight.
Okay, we're back. This is Dr. Rob Stahl with What Should You Expect at Your Age? We welcome everyone to the second half of the show with my guest, Dr. Alex Gelfer, a physician who specializes in sleep problems, and Ms. Professor Linda Zemmel, a UB professor who is an expert in the meaning of dreams. If you'd like to call in and ask any of us a question about sleep problems or dreams, the phone number again is 855-6848, and Linda is looking for your call. She wants to interpret your dream or dreams for you. Now, why don't we start with you, Linda? We were talking a little bit. I told you what my favorite dream throughout my whole life. It's still very vivid.
Right.
It occurred when I was about 7 years old. I was living in New York City in Washington Heights. That's in Manhattan, 187th Street. And Amsterdam Avenue, and I was an avid Superman fan, the TV show that started in black and white and then went to color, and we had to go next door to see it in color. But my favorite dream was me flying over the playground where I learned to ride a bike, where I went to preschool, dug in a sandbox to China, things like that. And I woke up and it was just exhilarating. I was flying over, you know, turning my head like Superman does, and right over the playground.
And it's a wonderful dream, and I think flying dreams frequently do give people a feeling of exhilaration. All of the things that we can't do because we're so earthbound, right? We have to stick here because of gravity. Am I right?
Right.
You know, we generally can't just sort of fly. You can do those things in your dreams. As a matter of fact, some experts say that when you find yourself in your dreams doing things that human beings really can't do, go for it. Have a wonderful time in your dream. Don't sort of diss yourself or demean yourself while you're still sleeping if you're a lucid dreamer, right? In your dream. Don't say, oh gosh, why am I doing this? How silly. Go with it and enjoy it, because after all, it's not real. You can, in fact, do those things. I think that, as I was mentioning to you earlier over coffee, one of the things that you might want to do, having remembered this dream from when you were seven and still enjoying that feeling of exhilaration that you had then, remembering that feeling, is to ask yourself, and actually your listeners may want to try this. You can try this at home. Okay. This isn't,
this
like
isn't dangerous.
Don't
this
try
isn't
this
dangerous.
You can try this at home. This is a good
unless
one.
Unless you're one of those REM people who aren't paralyzed and act out what goes on.
We don't
want
to know about that.
Well, they first come to us to help them to sleep and dream, and then they come to Linda to interpret their dreams.
Okay.
Well, here's my suggestion, though. Seriously, for those of you who want to have a particular kind of dream, for instance, in your case, Dr. Stahl, to maybe try that again and see what you would see now, before you go to bed for several nights in a row, ask yourself in a respectful tone to have that kind of dream again. You would say to yourself, I'd really like to have a dream where I would see myself flying, or where I would be flying over some place where I could look down and see whatever it is my dreaming mind wants me to see that night. And ask yourself for several nights running before you go to bed for that dream, until in fact your unconscious finally gets a clue and realizes that's what you're asking for, and in fact gives you that dream. You know, if you remember that your dreams are just your mind giving you hunches at night, it demystifies that part of the process. People sometimes wonder whether dreams are terribly, you know, mystical and kind of out of our reach, and the answer is no. They are yours. They're part of who you are. And if you work with them and become friends with them and become friends with all of your mind, if you catch my drift, not just your conscious mind that pays the bill in the daytime, but your unconscious mind that is giving you clues and hunches at night. You can learn all kinds of things about how you relate to the world, how other people actually do think about you. The characters in your dreaming life give you messages that are from your own unconscious mind. You are picking up, do you see what I mean? It's not
sure.
messages from heaven knows where. It's a message from your own intuition.
Well, I read recently, I can't remember who mentioned it or where the quote was from, that that the waking life is just the stuff you do in between sleep.
I love that.
And that sleep is really where it's at.
Well, you know, if that person came to me, I think I'd probably have a little chat about, you know, is there something you might want to do in your everyday life that might be fun too?
Well, but then, you know, there are the people that meditate, that believe in a silent life and meditation as the key to the universe. And how does that relate to this concept of how important sleep
very, might be? Very much. Relates. And interestingly enough, meditation and dreams are my own two ways of getting in touch with what's going on in my life. Those are my two methods.
Well, we want to cover some of the things you can do to help problems with sleeping. And first, let's start off, there are various questionnaires that help give you an idea of how well you're sleeping, whether you have a sleep problem, whether you're what's called sleep hygiene. Are you doing the things or behaving in a way that's conducive to sleep? What can you tell us about that, Dr. Gelber? What are the key points there? And then let's start getting into what can be done about it.
First of all, duration of sleep. It's very important to have 7 hours of sleep. Being a sleep physician, I made sure myself that I have at least 7 hours of sleep every night. It's important to have sleep in one piece, not fragmented, not to have a 2 hours here, 2 hours there. The main sleep episode, as we call, the main sleep should be around 7 hours.
Now, is seven the absolute minimum for everyone? Does it vary between people? Can people really get by on 5 hours of sleep, like you hear, or do some people absolutely need 10 hours of sleep?
I heard the story that Napoleon used to sleep 45 minutes, but it was Napoleon. I think that as an average, people need 7 hours plus minus two. In other words, would be, I'm sorry, 8 hours plus minus two. Normal sleep would be from 6 to 10 hours. If somebody will sleep shorter than 6 hours and still doing well, no physical conditions or no mental problems related to the shorter sleep, this person would be called short sleeper. If the person needs more than 10 hours of sleep, again, doesn't exhibit any medical problems, any psychological problems, and feel well, it would be a long sleeper. But we keep the person between 6 and 10 hours sleep and would be, on average, 8 hours of sleep. The study showed that when they started go, the person started going below 7 hours of sleep, it will have some impact on his long-term memory because we all have our sleep bank that we need to feel periodically, and if we have a few days that we sleep about 6 hours and then on the weekend we catch up and have another 2 hours during the weekend time, we can function this way. But if chronically somebody sleeps less than 6 hours every single night, they definitely will exhibit some signs of sleep deprivation. The most dangerous actually driving is sleep deprivation.
Well, you know, clearly falling asleep at the wheel is a major cause of accidents, fatal accidents especially. Now, what are some of the things people can do to help ensure a good night's sleep? And what are habits that people tend to have in this day and age that inhibit a good night's sleep?
Well, there are several sleep tips that I would mention today, very important. I don't want to sound boring, but first of all, maintaining regular bed and wake time. It's important. Establish a regular relaxing pattern before going to bed. For some people, it could be light music. For some people, it could be a cup of herbal tea, non-caffeinated, definitely. For some, it would be a hot bath. As a matter of fact, people who have difficulty falling asleep, the hot bath for about 20 minutes before going to bed would be very important. We all know that animals sleep in the cold environment. When a change of temperature from hot to cold, it stimulates the sleep in animals and the same thing in people. Therefore, we recommend our patients sometimes to take hot bath for 20 minutes, about an hour before their bedtime, then put the warm robe on, relax, bring a small cup of herbal tea, warm themselves up, then take the robe off and go to the cool room, which will stimulate their sleep and usually easier to fall asleep this way.
Mm. That's interesting.
People like to watch TV. We don't recommend to have a TV in the bedroom, but for some patients it helped. It helped them to relax. But definitely, it shouldn't be trying to watch TV through the sleep, because this person will train himself to sleep very superficially, try to pay attention to TV while trying to fall asleep, which is very detrimental for sleep. To hear light music, to have a TV on auto shut off would be fine, but trying to watch news through the sleep, it's no.
So Leno and the other talk show hosts that are on in the later evening, they might be really adversely affecting the American population in terms of getting a good night's sleep. Is that possible?
For some people who needs to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, definitely. For some who would be able to sleep till 9, I see no problem watching late show.
Okay. Now, what about things like alcohol smoking and exercise?
Let's start with exercise. Exercise is very helpful for people with sleep disorders. It would organize their day and also would help them to utilize their energy for something else, not to be so active. During the sleep. However, the exercise should be at least 3 hours before the bedtime.
Three hours before.
If you're exercising just before the bedtime, it actually would decrease the ability to fall asleep. It will keep person too active.
Does exercise first thing in the morning, a lot of people do it before they go to work, does that help the night's sleep later on?
Definitely, exercise in the morning helps, and also bright light help in the morning, especially in Buffalo when we sometimes have a dark morning. It would be very important, if you want to feel awake, to turn all light on. It's not the same as a special light, about 1,000 lux or 8,000 lux that you could be irradiated in the morning to improve your wake.
Irradiated. Well, maybe you shouldn't use that term, but you told me that I guess they make these lights in Buffalo too, so it might also be stimulating the local economy. By getting these lights, these are lights that simulate sunlight. I believe they have they're broad spectrum lights.
Broad spectrum, bright enough to stimulate the sunlight.
Okay, so 1,000 lux. How bright is that? How does that compare to watts in light bulbs?
I think about 20 light bulbs in the same 100 light bulbs watt. In the
2,000
is
1,000 lux
in the same direction.
Wow, so that's bright.
It's bright.
And what does that do physiologically? I think it does stimulate production of certain substances in the body.
We all know about the circadian rhythm. Mm-hmm. In our brain, we have the area that responds to light, and the light promotes wakefulness. Therefore, having this very bright light actually promotes the wakefulness in people. And having this bright light as a mean to keep person awake, we're also utilizing in sleep medicine, we're using the bright light for treatment of sleep disorder. Using the bright light, would be able to shift their sleep time to early or late time, depending when we're going to give the patient bright light.
Now, while we're on different treatments, there's tryptophan that people have heard of, there's melatonin, there's certainly sleeping pills, that Tylenol PM is a medication I don't like to give, and I've mentioned that several times in the course of this radio show, that it's basically an antihistamine, Benadryl, thrown in with Tylenol, which is generally not good at all for older people. So how do you approach the medicinal means of dealing with sleep problems?
We always try to get the history, why a person takes this medication, what time, and what we can do to take the patient away from medications. And sometimes try to promote relaxation techniques or using the hot bath therapy to promote falling asleep. because it will take time for those means to work, we give the patient sleeping medications until other means and methods start working on them. Therefore, we always use a combination of hypnotics or sleeping medication with non-medication therapy for sleep disorder.
Now, can medications themselves cause, well, I know that as a geriatrician that there are medications that could cause sleeping problems, and what do you encounter most frequently along those lines?
The main thing is excessive sleepiness and fogginess in the morning when the person wakes up and he's too sleepy to act, too sleepy to drive. And for adult people, especially people who depend on somebody, it could create a situation when they're so foggy that they try to do something on their own not they're supposed to do, even try to walk to the bathroom. They need to have the assistance to go to the bathroom. And unfortunately, it could lead to terrible things like falling and fracturing the hip or fracturing the pelvis. We had several patients with those problems related to sleeping medication.
And being foggy in the morning, no doubt, is going to affect your sleep cycle, how your sleep occurs when it's supposed to occur later in the day at night, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Now, Linda, you've been taking all kinds of notes, drawing pictures. I don't know what that means. Tell me more about dreams and what you do therapeutically. You mentioned collecting the pieces of paper, mm-hmm. jotting down what your dreams are. How do you piece those together, and what interesting things have come out of that?
Yeah, funny you should ask that. One way of dealing with dreams that has worked well for me is to have people come and attend what's called a dream circle or a dream group. And this isn't anything that I created out of, you know, thin air. These are all over the country, and they've been written up extensively in newspapers. People who get together out of their own interest in dreams and the fact that they have been journaling dreams for years and wish they knew somebody else who was doing it. And you can get together with someone who leads the group like me, or you can have a leaderless group, just people who are interested and follow the dreams. And what you do is to meet in each other's homes usually or at the home of the leader once a week. You bring dreams with you that you would like to share. You certainly don't want to share everything necessarily, but the things that you would like to share, and you read them out loud to each other, and after you yourself tell what you see in your dream, you open it up so that other people can give you what they think they see. Now, clearly, as the dreamer, number one, you only share what you want to share. Number two, you don't need to accept what other people say as true. It's simply a way to get some feedback from other people and to offer your own feedback. It's also salutary for people who sometimes worry that they are into something that they view or that the rest of the world may view as a little bit abstruse, to meet with people who have similar interests and who place a similar value on their dreams. That itself, in any kind of a methodology, can be a comfort and can be therapeutic, simply the company of other people who share your interests and value those modes of healing that you yourself value. So for that reason, dream circles are a good thing. If people were to come to me with a problem, and for years I was on the faculty of the National Guild of Hypnotists, so I used to see people on a fairly regular basis. Who,
you have your stopwatch in your pocket?
I do. I have. Yeah. Actually, I have one I wear around my neck. But the funny thing is, see, there it is. The funny thing
it is. Maybe we'll take a picture of that for the website.
The funny thing is that you don't need a stopwatch to hypnotize people, and that's the honest truth. Most hypnosis, in fact, virtually all hypnosis is self-hypnosis in the company of somebody who will sit there while you're doing it. That's really the function.
I don't think that would have been as visual as cartoons and things.
Stopwatch, but the truth is that's true. But when people would come with various issues that they were dealing with, whether it was, for instance, chronic pain or insomnia, or wanting to get better at some skill, learning how to concentrate better on something. I mean, it isn't all stop smoking and eating. That's sort of the very beginnings of what popular uses of hypnosis are about. It really is a serious tool in the right hands. And I believe that in some cases people with physical ailments can benefit both from diminishing anxiety through hypnosis. It can be wonderful for anxiety and also for some people with depression, but you need to have their physician's permission, you know, for that sort of thing. That along with learning to relax, learning to look at your dreams can be helpful in that it gives you insight into yourself. Sometimes when people come with problems, it's that they aren't looking at those problems. They're desperately trying not to. And if, in fact, you can open them up a little bit to talking about what's going on in their dreams, they can address the problem in sort of a tangential way without saying, I'm worried about my health, or I'm worried about my son, or I'm worried about my finances, or whatever the thing may be. They can tell you through the dream characters and the dream events what's on their mind. And even if they never actually say, I'm worried about XYZ, in fact, the unconscious mind will understand that they are getting at the problem, if you see what I mean.
Sure.
Your mind cooperates with itself quite nicely, even when you're talking metaphorically.
Yeah, it's almost like a fourth-person analogy. You talk about the first person, second person, third person, and then now we have our dreams, which is a fourth person that's out there that you can utilize.
Well, and you know, if you look at the old photographs of Freud's study, they're all over. In just about every psychology book, you will see a photograph of Freud's study with the fainting couch, you know, and the pictures on the wall, and he had a hideously tapestried office. I mean, it would have given anybody claustrophobia, I think, to be in there. But when you see photographs of it, he's got hangings all over and tchotchkes all over every surface that could possibly have a doodad on it. But people, in facing away from the therapist the way that, you know, the echt Freudians would do, have the advantage that sometimes is there in dreams, that is, of not facing directly the listener to the problem. Are you sort of seeing what I'm talking about? You have a little bit of distance between you and the listener when you're talking about dreams because you're talking in a metaphor. I'll tell you something funny. I have a fainting couch that is Victorian in my living room. Bought it in an antique store years ago. And in a different house than I was living in now, I once had a study that was not hideously tapestried the way his was, but I had a study in which I did have some interesting wall hangings. I had just bought this couch, and I opened up a psychology book that I had used years and years ago as a student, and in front of me, in a Jungian moment, was Freud's study, and I looked at my den, and I thought, I think I've just recreated Vienna here in Rochester, wow. New York, where I currently was. But I still have that. I still have that couch, and people can lie on it if they want to.
Fascinating. A quick question about dreams. They seem like they could last for hours, and how long do they actually last when you're sleeping?
Well, REM sleep. Let's talk about the dreams that we remember. About 25% of our total sleep time.
Now. So is a dream, does a dream that seems like it's going on for an hour, does it actually take an hour in REM sleep?
Usually not.
Okay.
We think we compress our time in the dreams. But really, you know, we think about a lot of different things in the dream, and they sounds like, you know, and look like last for a long time, but they're happening with a very short period of time.
Hmm. Is that your experience too?
Do you know, I'm fascinated to hear that because I have no way of gauging how long a dream takes. I'm delighted to hear that there is some way of figuring it out. One experience that I myself have had, I would say fairly frequently, is having a dream that I then wake up from. In other words, an intense dream, and then kaboom, it's 6:30 in the morning and time to get up. So I'm wondering, do we tend to have vivid dreams just before awakening? Does that sound right?
It sounds right because the REM sleep, the most prolonged and the deepest in early morning hours, just before our waking.
Yes.
Therefore, I'm not surprised that you have the longest and deepest dream in that time, more vivid one.
Well, I, for one, I'm going to follow up with Dr. Gelfer with regard to the sleep apnea possibility, and I think I'm going to touch base with Linda Zemmel about dreams and what the crazy dreams that I have and trying to recreate that flying dream, what all of that might mean and how it can enrich my life.
I'll dust off the red couch.
That sounds good. and I didn't know it was a fainting couch. I thought it was just the shrink's couch that you lay on so you can look up in the air and kind of talk about things.
They're called fainting couches.
Fainting couches.
Yeah.
Okay. I want you each to tell me how people can reach you. What's the best contact mechanism, Dr. Gelfer?
They can reach myself or my partners at the Pullman Group of Western New York, number, which is 716 631-8863 or call St. Joseph Hospital Sleep Laboratory, which is 891-2782.
Okay, and our dream expert and hypnotist.
Well, and, what can I tell you?
And literary person, English professor, writer.
Well, that's true. Actually, can I plug my show?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay, a play that I wrote, this is my third stage play, and it's being presented at the UB Center for the Arts in the screening room on March 12th. So if you want information about that,
and what's it about?
You can call UB Center for the Arts. It's called Reunion, and the premise is two people in midlife, I make them in their 50s so that I would understand them, right, who get together on the telephone about 2 months in advance of their class reunion. They haven't seen each other in about 38 years since they graduated from high school, and the entire play takes place on the telephone. The entire play is their phone conversations 2 months before the reunion. You never see the class reunion in the play. The reunion is actually their reunion prior to the event.
Ah,
so it's funny and it's poignant, and I hope that you will come. If you're looking for tickets to that, you want to call the UB Center for the Arts, and I believe that is 645-ARTS, 645-ARTS. If you want to reach me personally to talk about your dreams or to inquire about forming a dream circle, I would be delighted to help with that. And you can reach me at home. If you call UB and ask for the dream circle, they'll say, oh, no, Linda's been on radio again, so please don't call the English department. I liked my job. I need it, so don't get me fired. Call me at home about dreams, which is 631-5323, or may I give you an email address? Is that
absolutely
okay?
Absolutely, sure.
You can email me at writer14221, that's WRITER 14221, at buffalo.com. That's what I do and where I live.
Well, this has been fascinating. I think we've covered a lot of really interesting material. I think a lot of it people can put into action right away. Contact Dr. Gelfer, the numbers again, his office, 631-8863, the sleep lab at St. Joseph's Hospital, 891-2782, and Linda Zemel, she gave you her contact numbers, 631-5323, email writer14221, I presume that's your zip code,
that's right.
at buffalo.com, not EDU, I guess, it's buffalo.com.
Well, Buffalo EDU is a different email address, and I'd prefer the people not
okay,
contact
so
it, me.
Okay, so it's
EB,
buffalo.com,
yeah.
writer14221 at buffalo.com. And that's about all the time we have for today. Thank you so much, both of you. It was terrific.
Thank
I had a lot
so
of fun and very
me.
Interesting.
Thank you very much for having me.
Next month, the first Monday of March, March 7th at 3 p.m., I'll have with me Dr. Evan Calkins, the person, my mentor, who got me interested in geriatrics, and Ms. Linda Cabala, a registered nurse who is president of the Western New York Network in Aging, to talk about the past, present, and future of geriatric care. This is Dr. Rob Stahl. See you then.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? Have gone. You can knit a sweater by the fireside. Sunday mornings go for a ride. Doing a garden, digging the weeds. Who could ask for more? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? Every summer we can rent a cottage in the Isle of Wight, if it's not too dear. We shall scrimp and save. Grandchildren on your knee, Vera, Chuck and Dave. Send me a postcard, drop me a line, stating point of view. Indicate precisely what you mean to say. You're sincerely wasting away. Give me your answer, fill in a form, mine forevermore. Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Again, thank you for listening to At Your Age with Dr. Rob Starr. Gee, we have to wait a whole month before we hear from him again, but the first Monday in March on AM 1270 WHLD, At Your Age with Dr. Rob Starr. This is AM 1270 WHLD, a Citadel Broadcasting Communications Station.